Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Like many aspects of United States history, the story of the construction of the Transcontinental Railroad has been whitewashed, and important context has been erased. The real story is troubling and violent, rooted in imperialism, colonialism, racism, and exploitation. In his new book, Empire's Tracks, today's guest, Manu Kuruka, reframes the history of the Transcontinental Railroad from the perspectives of the Cheyenne, Lakota, and Pawnee Native tribes and the Chinese migrants who labored to build the railroad. He also writes about the context of violent histories of colonialism and capitalism around the world and links military occupation to exclusionary border policies. He writes, quote, "To understand the Transcontinental Railroad in terms of continental imperialism is to understand the development of the United States of America as an imperial state," end quote. Manu Kuruka is assistant professor of American Studies at Barnard College in New York, where he focuses on the intersections of imperialism and capitalism. And the full title of his book is Empire's Tracks, Indigenous Nations, Chinese Workers, and the Transcontinental Railroad. And Manu joins us in studio. Hi, thank you for coming in.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, thank you so much for this really incredible work. Before we dive in, can you tell us a little bit about your background and how you came to take on this project?
There's many ways I could narrate that. There's many stories. One way I think I could talk about it today is my family came here from another place. So I found myself, we came here, I was a few weeks old when we came to White Plains, New York, my parents and I. And I grew up in this place and, many of us growing up and asking, wondering, where am I? What is this place where I am? And hearing stories from my parents about our own family and our identity, not so much in terms of culture or, ancestry, but in terms of politics. My grandparents were of the generation that was fighting against colonialism and struggling against colonialism. My father, when he was born, the night he was born, my grandfather was in a jail for protesting, participating in a mass protest against colonialism. And so these are stories that are deeply ingrained in the sense of, this is who we are. This is our identity. We fight against colonialism. And so asking this question for me as a young child growing up in New Jersey, where am I in the world? And, if what we do is fight against colonialism, then what is colonialism in this place where I'm living? And so I think that's what drove me to the questions that I wanted to ask in this book, and really drove me to really thinking about the ways that the idea of the nation is created. And in many ways, I think there's a mythology of the nation here in North America. And so in some ways, that's one way I can talk about this, tell a story of how I came to this work, is really, taking up those stories that I've been told about who we are, let's say, my family, and then where we are, and trying to think about both those questions together.
It's interesting because we do so many shows about history on Your Call, and in the United States, we don't really learn much about the truth about U.S. history, especially colonialism. So it's interesting that obviously this was a conversation given your background. But can you talk a little bit about how did you learn about the history of this country growing up here?
I grew up in New Jersey, as I said, and I went to public schools. And there's a, like many of us, we hear these stories. The United States is a nation of immigrants. Mm-hmm. The United States is a nation of enterprise. It's a nation of thrift, of hard work. There are certain core values. The United States is exceptional. It's a city upon a hill. It's an example to humanity. Or as the previous president said, the United States is the last best hope of humankind. So all these, all of us have heard these stories. I grew up, like like many of the rest of us, pledging allegiance to the flag, singing the song about amber waves of grain, even though I'd never been to the place where the amber waves of grain, I'd never seen that myself, but we sang the song. So I think in many ways there was a disjuncture for me, knowing this history of colonialism and hearing these stories. And I grew up in the 80s, so hearing stories about, you know, the United States and Central America and its involvement with the Contras, let's say, and very violent involvement, you know, with, you know, really reactionary movements that are seeking to break people's, you know, visions of hope and experiments in hope and community. And so, you know, those I think were, even as a child, disjunctures that I could see. You know, there's stories that I'm hearing and saying, and there's practices that I'm involved with in school, like pledging allegiance to the flag. And then there's other things that people are telling me about, older people in my neighborhood, my community are telling me about, that really don't seem to click, you know, with these other stories.
Right.
Yeah.
And as an assistant professor of American Studies at Barnard College in New York, where do you see this place in history? Because before the show, we were talking about how it seems like there's so much awareness raising for many reasons. I was thinking about Native Twitter. A lot of Native Americans are telling their own stories on social media. Standing Rock really just changed the narrative on so many issues. And then there's so many books. I mean, your book, when I saw Empire's Tracks, Indigenous Nations, Chinese Workers and the Transcontinental Railroad, I thought, great, another one. There's so many new books coming out. We were just talking about the two books about California genocide. We're talking about statues are coming down. Black Lives Matter has changed the conversation. What are your thoughts about where we are right now, specifically when we're talking about raising awareness about these issues?
I think, I think we're in a situation of crisis in many ways. It's a deep crisis, and it's a crisis that we're living here in North America, but it's a crisis internationally. And, you know, that moment of crisis, also it's an opening, and it's unclear for us as we're living through it where that crisis will resolve. But in that opening, I think it opens up possibilities to remember earlier moments. And I agree, there's a great deal of work that's being done in Native studies and Indigenous studies. There's a great deal of work that's being done in thinking about imperialism. There's a great deal of work being done thinking about the political economy of racism, and it's really important. And also many of us are giving attention and thinking about the work together and collectively. And so it's a powerful moment. I do think we've lived through, in recent times when I'm in the classroom, I teach a generation of students, you know, who their entire lives, the United States has been at war in Afghanistan,
wow.
You know, the longest war in U.S. history. And they don't know anything outside of that. And, you know, many of them, another thing that's so interesting is many of them know this fact. And it's just like, you know, it's like refrigerator noise in the background.
Right.
Where I teach now at Barnard, it's interesting. I've taught a class called Planet America, where we think about the United States and its relationship to the world, you know, and the U.S. and the world, and really try to undo this idea of the domestic and the international. Domestic policy and foreign policy is somehow separate. And on the last day of class, I have asked the students, what I just said, the U.S. has been at war for most of you, your entire lives. So raise your hand if you have had any direct experience of the war, if you served in the military, or somebody in your life, or a good friend, a neighbor, you know, a relative, or if you were a civilian who was living in a place that was attacked or bombarded or occupied. And, you know, it's really interesting to see maybe two hands go up in a class of 70 people. And then for everybody to look around and say, well, we've been talking and thinking about war this whole time, you know, and trying to respond in really ethical ways to what we're learning and what we know is the world we're living in. And yet so many of us are so divorced from that reality, except that it's just, like I said, this kind of background noise.
Right.
So that, you know, shapes and conditions, I think, the life of a generation. And then you have Black Lives Matter and the movements against police brutality. Then you have Standing Rock and the movements at Standing Rock and Solidarity and the movements against, you know, Keystone XL, you know, and Flint. And, you know, that's the crisis. But this generation is living through the crisis. And I think pulled in many different ways. So as someone who's, you know, teaching in the classroom, it's an experience for me where I feel like I'm continually learning from the students, from their analysis and from what it is that they've lived and seen. And, you know, it feels like a conversation, a dialogue, when we're studying this stuff, studying this material over the course of 13, 14 weeks to think closely together.
Let's dive in and talk about your book. Why did you decide to focus on the Transcontinental Railroad? Again, you write, to understand it in terms of continental imperialism is to understand the development of the U.S. as an imperial state.
The Transcontinental Railroad, I think, is a really useful site to think about these questions, because the ways it's often remembered, the Transcontinental Railroad is in the histories. First of all, you can go to a university library, any university library, and you see easily 2.5 shelves worth of books and literature that have been written about the Transcontinental Railroad from 1870 to the present, let's say. And, you know, it's written about in this huge literature as a project, an infrastructure project that was initially, you know, it was initially a drive to build and control a trade network with China and capture and control the trade with China. And that story, you know, that argument or that history then is linked to the building of the Suez Canal. So the Suez Canal is completed just right after the Transcontinental Railroad here in North America is completed, and that makes the railroad kind of obsolete technology infrastructure for that purpose of capturing trade with China. But then in the histories, it's written about in this way that there are these unanticipated effects of the Transcontinental. It produces a national political economy. It produces a national infrastructure and a national culture. And in so many ways, the consolidation of the United States after the Civil War, the reconsolidation of the United States happens through the railroad itself. And this is how the history is written often. I think of it almost like this image in my mind. And I think, you know, I've seen it written about in really beautifully in some poetry in this way that the Transcontinental Railroad is almost like a suture that's knitting together a country that's cleaved apart during the Civil War, and it knits it back together. Now, all these stories and these images presume a lot of things. They presume, for example, that North America is the United States. It presumes that the United States is a country that will control territory from the Atlantic coast to the Pacific coast. It presumes these things are inevitable, and we're destined to be. And I think there's also a presumption in the histories that this is the way things are, that they'll always be this way as well, that the history is not only inevitable, but it's closed in a way. And, you know, for me, looking closely at the archives that these historians in this huge literature have cited, one of the interesting things is to see there's nothing inevitable about this. And in many ways, this was not the United States. For the people from the United States who were there on the ground, they were very clear. They're in somebody else's country. They're in foreign country. Many of them did not want to be there.
Can you tell us more about that?
Well, you know, one of the interesting things is the union, the Transcontinental, the first Transcontinental was, there were two companies that built it.
Right.
One was the Union Pacific Railroad, which began in Omaha, it started construction in Omaha and moved westward. And the other was the Central Pacific Railroad, which, you know, that line began in Sacramento and moved eastward. So the Union Pacific Railroad, from the highest echelons of the company down to the people on the ground, was a corporation and a workforce that was largely made of veterans of the U.S. Civil War. And this was kind of the way that that railroad was organized, the way that the construction, the strategy of actually how do you build season to season, month to month, was shaped by this experience of war and this relationship, a real kind of relationship of occupation to the plains, to the Central Plains where it was building through. And it was also built in relationship with the U.S. Army. And so there were units of U.S. soldiers who were following and moving along with the groups of railroad workers, protecting them, providing protection, sentries, and things like this. And also there were units of soldiers who were sent out to survey land in advance of the railroad to see what's a good path to build. And also, what resources are there? Is there places where can we find water for the steam engines? Where can we find coal to power the engines? Where can we find timber? Are there other resources that we can take and capitalize? You know, minerals, that, things that can be mined and be, you know, profit to be made from that. And so, you know, one of the really interesting things for me is looking at some of these records of the soldiers. These are veterans of the Civil War. Mm. And there's one unit, I think, the man's name is Charles Springer, and they were sent. It was a unit of infantry, if I remember correctly, and they're moving through Lakota country, and it's a horrid experience. And they're leaving. You know, he left a journal behind, and every day he recorded these conversations that these soldiers would have together. You know, we signed up to fight a civil war, It was horrid, you know, the bloodiest war in U.S. history in that time. And they survived this. And then they're sent to somebody else's country. And they have no idea why they're there. And they, you know, even the weather itself is something that's shocking to them. You know, the changes in weather. There's one morning they wake up and there was a cold snap. And they wake up to see that all the horses and the mules have died overnight. And here they are stranded. Cavalry, you know. So they're trying to make sense of where are we and why are we here? I didn't sign up for this. Hmm. I don't want to be here. And Springer leaves at one point. He sees a man who he served with earlier during the Civil War, a white American man. And I think, you know, they have this conversation, they have this encounter. And this man had, like Springer, been sent to serve in Lakota country. And what he did is he ended up actually leaving the army, deserting, and intermarrying into a Lakota community. Mm. And he's now working as an interpreter. And so he tells his old friend, Springer, he says, you know, this is good. You should do this. I mean, I'm happy. You know, you should consider this. And Springer writes in his journal that there was no way he wanted to do that. He just wanted to go home. And so one of the lessons for me, you know, in that moment to look at, you know, this one person's journal, it's as if he's saying there's two options for a white American man in Lakota country at this time. Mm. You either assimilate into Lakota life or you leave and you return back to where you came from. And, wow. You know, those are the two options. And then he wanted to go back where he came from. Yeah.
I want to read from the first section of your chapter called Lakota. You write, long before the Transcontinental Railroad, Lakota sustained their collective lives through expansive relationships that they forged with each other and with their homelands. Luther Standing Bear once wrote of this expansive relationship to place, quote, "No people ever loved their country or enjoyed it more than the Sioux. They loved the beautiful streams by which they camped and the trees that shaded them and their teepees. They loved the green stretches of plains with its gardens here and there of sunflowers over which hovered and played myriads of yellow-winged birds. Moving day was just like traveling from one nice home to another," end quote. I love that last sentence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do too. I think it's a really beautiful and really concrete window into a very different way of relating to the place. Mm. Yeah.
And again, then another section that was so fascinating. I mean, you've got all these bits of information that are just so interesting. So you write, again, in the Lakota chapter, "Indigenous land rights enshrined through treaties fundamentally contradicted land grants to the Union Pacific Railroad Company as provided by the 1862 Pacific Railroad Act. President Lincoln signed the act into law on July 1st, 1862, incorporating the Union Pacific Railroad Company to be financed by 100,000 shares initially valued at $1,000. The future orientation of the shares reflected the future orientation of Congress's sovereign claims over these lands. The law renamed indigenous lands as, quote, public lands, authorizing the Union Pacific to use dirt, stone, and timber for construction." Mm-hmm. And I was just thinking the other day, we did a show about the Trump administration's effect on public lands. We use that term without even thinking about it today.
Yeah, public lands. I mean, in west of the Mississippi, the U.S. Federal government administers, enormous swaths of public lands. And this is what shapes not only the development of railroad infrastructure, but then the development of ranching and mining and monocrop agriculture and irrigation systems. And also the development of military testing and military forts. All of these are created by the public land. And of course, the public land is really land that is the U.S. federal government has taken and, in the let's say, most generous interpretation, administering on behalf of Native communities. So that's the most generous. I mean, the realistic interpretation is abrogating its own treaties, that Congress has abrogated its own treaties that it signed with nations across this area, and has taken their land and is giving it, at cut rate, let's say, vastly below market rates to ranching interests, to agricultural interests, to mining interests, and that's that this begins in the late 1860s, and it continues to shape the use and the land and the capitalization of the land, transforming the land into a vehicle for property, for capital, for profits. That continues to this day.
To this day, right, yeah. Because in that show we talked about how oil and gas companies are getting that land for a very, very low price, the public lands.
Yes.
And before we go to break, I wanted to ask you about another section in the Lakota chapter in your book, Empire's Tracks. A month after the Pacific Railway Act planted a legislated flag on Lakota lands on August 17, 1862, Lakota's eastern relatives rose up against famine and assault in Minnesota. Can you tell us what happened there?
There had been a long period in Minnesota of both incursions, and again, these are an abrogation of the treaty, incursions on Dakota land, and also failures to fulfill the treaty obligations to Dakota people. And so it was in a, conditions of both violence, treaty violations, and real hunger, real suffering, that Dakota people rose up and, tried to organize together in a way to try to defend their rights to have food, to not be attacked on their land. And this uprising was crushed by the U.S. Army. The survivors were treated as enemy combatants, to use a more contemporary term. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they were treated as enemies of the United States. And to this day, is one of the reverberations of that moment, the historical moment. President Lincoln signed the order to have the largest mass public execution of Dakota patriots, of men who were involved in this uprising. And so, these are disjunctures of U.S. history. This is Abraham Lincoln. This is during the Civil War. And this is at the time that they're debating, and Lincoln himself is transforming his own views on the centrality of abolition and emancipation, mm-hmm. To the Civil War. The necessity of that, and at the same time that you have this intensification of colonial warfare and that ends up producing, the modern day outlines that save Minnesota, the society of Minnesota.
And 38 men were executed. You write, 6 days after that happened, Lincoln signed the Emancipation Proclamation. This timing reflects more than a mere coincidence. A formal end to slavery occurred in a context of financialized territorial expansion. The dissolution of the slave property claim would pair with the expansion of real estate claims that originate in theft, occupation, and genocide.
Yes, so, I just caught myself just now that I think there's a gap between abolition and emancipation. Mm. If we're going to talk about the abolition of slavery, there's a territorial and land dimension to that question.
Yeah, yeah. I just really, the visual of that, 6 days after that happened.
Mm-hmm.
it's just really, really powerful.
Yeah. And I mean, so you invoked the current administration. And so to think these are unfolding. We're all living in this time and watching this happen. So when we read it in a textbook, it might be in a different chapter. So this is the way the history is organized.
Exactly.
You know, you might have a chapter on African-American history and another chapter on Native American history. But when you read them at the same time as people were living it, then you see, okay, so Abraham Lincoln himself is making, he's signing this order, and 6 days later he's signing another order. And what's the connection between, you know, these two moments? These
and
two
I have orders? I have not seen that movie Lincoln, but I'm guessing that this connection is not in that movie.
Well, I haven't seen the movie either, but I'm with you.
Yeah. Today we're speaking with Manu Karuka, Assistant Professor of American Studies at Barnard College in New York, where he focuses on the intersections of imperialism and capitalism. He is the author of the new book, Empire's Tracks, Indigenous Nations, Chinese Workers, and the Transcontinental Railroad. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us an email, yourcall@kalw.org. And if you'd like to join today's conversation with Manu Karuka, he's the author of Empire's Tracks, Indigenous Nations, Chinese Workers, and the Transcontinental Railroad. If you have any questions, we'd love to hear from you. This is a piece of U.S. history that sure deserves more attention. It's really about the Transcontinental Railroad. This history has really been whitewashed. The important context has been erased. Before we get to questions, I have to say, when I read those two paragraphs that we just talked about before the break, I kind of got chills. And I wonder, you know, a lot of us know these pieces of information, but I understand that a big light went off for you when you wrote them down in chronological order. Can you talk about what that process was like?
Yeah, so it wasn't only the case with those paragraphs that you read, but in other sections of the book where I knew this, you know, I knew these things, and they're separate geographies, and they're separated in a way, in the way we learn them and think about them in the university, for example. And, you know, we began this conversation with thinking about identity. And the ways we think about identity also, we tend to track ourselves and separate ourselves in these ways. It was in my process of writing where I knew this stuff and I'd been reading it and I was writing out the chronological timeline. And that's when I realized, oh, wait a second, these are 6 days apart. Or some of these decisions, Supreme Court decisions that I cite later, these happen on the same day. Mm-hmm. And even to this day, one decision is taken as a root point for immigration law and the other is taken as a root point for corporation law. And they happen on the same day. You know, the court was thinking through and responding to both these cases, and today when we think about those two sets of laws, we don't necessarily see that not simultaneity, but the moment, the historical moment in which you know, these decisions are being made. It's also to think about us as people living through, you know, the current historical moment, and as we read, each of us, and we're learning what's happening, and we see we're living through this process that's unfolding. I think in our historical memory, it can be helpful to also remember that these were people living through a process of history that was unfolding and making decisions about how they wanted to respond and what they thought they needed to do.
Hmm. Well, let's hear from a caller. Let's go to Ariane in San Francisco. Hi, Ariane. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, I think it's really important, and I would ask your guest, this is a very important conversation about how to understand the intention behind freeing the slaves at the same time there was a massacre. You know, in a way, the Native Americans, the Sioux, who were starved out and not allowed to buy even food at the general store after their lands were taken away. They were sequestered, and then they were demonized as rapists. There was no rape. There was nothing like that. And this kind of confusion continues to go on in the sense that the government uses divide and conquer tactics to enhance our anxiety so that we turn some of our control over to the government, whether it's through the police or the military. And this needs to be really flushed out. So I don't know if Lincoln was trying to actually give something to someone and take something away from others, but I think he was ambivalent about the hangings of these Sioux. I'm not exactly sure, but he knew that the crowd wanted their blood and wanted much more than 38 people to be killed. And people are still conditioned to fear people when so much so that the people we fear, we really have to understand that the aggression is coming in from inside of us and we're projecting it outwards. And then we fear the people that we're, you know, harming through violent acts. So this is what I want to talk about more if your guest could.
Thank you, Ariane.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate that. You know, I think just hearing you talk now makes me It makes me think of some conversations I've had with students in the mm-hmm. classroom, whereas in the beginning of the semester, maybe as I've had students come up to me and say, you know, I really don't like history. You know, I don't do well with all the dates and stuff. And I say, well, you know, stick with it. You know, I'm going to try to tell you some stories and maybe we'll think about ideas. So when we think about history and really think about history and really study it, I think it can actually raise questions for us, deep questions. You know, just hearing you talk now makes me think, well, what is freedom? What is solidarity? And what exactly does this mean when we think about the history that's unfolding in this way and the decisions? I mean, we could think about Lincoln. You know, that might be interesting. I'm interested in the decisions that others are making. You know, what are the choices that somebody like Harriet Tubman is making or that somebody like Crazy Horse is making as this history is unfolding? Mm. Those are interesting to think. You know, today is April 4th. We were talking before about, you know, this is the anniversary on this day in 1967 that Dr. King gave a speech at Riverside Memorial Church where he came out against the Vietnam War. That's a vision of freedom and solidarity. And a year after that to the day, also April 4th, 1968, Dr. King was assassinated. And he was assassinated for coming out in many ways against that war, coming out in solidarity with Vietnamese people's right to govern themselves. So I think just hearing you talk makes me think about these deeper questions. What do we mean by freedom today? What do we mean by freedom?
Right. And also talking about U.S. imperialism, that was a huge part of Dr. King's speech, whereas many of his colleagues said you really don't want to go there.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's also remember his courage and the cost that he paid for that.
Hmm. Yeah. Okay, speaking of courage and cost, you have another interesting story in the book. Just thinking about the choices that people have to make when people are coming in to steal their land and kill their family members. In August of 1867, you write about a group of Cheyenne men. They first wrecked an approaching hand car and later decided to try to derail a train. They did derail the train very successfully, and then they took food, clothing, and other goods in the damaged car. You write that this train derailing, quote, frequently appears in histories of the Transcontinental Railroad as an anecdote of random savagery. I mean, this is, you know, people going from the East Coast to the West Coast, they were told these stories about the savages, and that's what they believed. To the contrary, Cheyennes derailed the train as the nexus of wear and finance. So can you talk about some of these stories about, I guess, can we call it resistance, about what people did when this was happening on their lands?
Yeah, so that story is like, As you read from that section, when I read through that literature, those 2.5 shelves, let's say, of books, it's really interesting. That anecdote keeps reappearing, and there's never any analysis. There's never any explanation. It's like this local color or something, you know. And what you're left with as a reader when you read this is thinking, oh, you know, these are these these are savages. I can sympathize with the fear of the railroad workers, or the fear of the settlers who are there, their fear of these people who seem to have no logic, no rationality. They just rush in and do this. Mm. Well, when you consider it from the perspective of Cheyenne history, then you start to see, oh, there may be a logic here. There may be some rational decisions that are being made. So, for example, with Cheyenne history, what at least how I understand it, how I've come to understand it from doing the research and thinking about it, looking at these archives, you know, Cheyenne people, people within the Cheyenne Nation were thinking about how do they adjust their collective lives, and by how do they feed themselves, you know, how do they make sure that they're safe and that their families are safe and not attacked. And before the railroad came through, Cheyennes had organized their lives around trade, their collective life, the national life around trade. And one of the effects of the railroad was to break off that trade, the trade between different indigenous nations, and also with Mexicans as well in the area, and really break that off. And Cheyennes and others living in the area were isolated as a result of the imposition of the railroad and the U.S. controlled fur trade before that. And so this was a response. It was one response among others. But you know, these kinds of raids were responses to get food, to get clothes, and also to make sure that the community is safe. Mm. And so that's one form we can think of as resistance. Mm. There's another form we can think, for example, in a very different history in the Pawnee Nation, where the U.S. government had instituted a series of policies to impose commercial farming on Pawnees, and also boarding schools for Pawnee children. And both these were intended to break the relationships and the knowledge and the work of Pawnee women who were the farmers and had farmed for generations, and also Pawnee grandmothers who really, you know, were core. This is a core relationship in the lives of their grandchildren. And the U.S. actually failed for decades. Decades afterwards, Pawnee women were farming five times the amount of land that the commercial farmers are farming.
I have to read this quote in your book. In 1835, John Dunbar, a Presbyterian missionary, commented on Pawnee gender relations, quote, "The Pawnee women are very laborious. It is rare they are seen idle. When a Pawnee woman has nothing to do, she seems to be out of her element. Their women are mere slaves. The men are lazy." Yeah. And then you go on to write, "Dunbar metaphorically invoked slavery as a moral justification for continental imperialism. He was incapable of understanding that Pawnee women's hard and constant work sustained interrelationships across households, villages, and nations."
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And maybe one way we can think about this is, I mean, let's maybe think about this question of freedom again. Mm-hmm. You know, for Dunbar, seeing Pawnee women working so hard meant to him that they're not free, you know, in his conception of freedom. Mm-hmm. But for the women themselves, you know, they continue to, they fought to continue working hard for decades, you know, so it maybe is a different kind of conception of freedom there. And the quote you just read also, you know, this is one reason why I think the framework of imperialism is really important for me in this book, because there are connections to draw with other places. Dunbar is a missionary sent from New England to Pawnee country, and he's looking and saying, okay, there's a kind of slavery happening here, and this country, our country, the United States, has fought a war against, he's against slavery. So that his reading of slavery in Pawnee life becomes a justification then for colonialism, for an administrative occupation, let's say, of Pawnee life. Now, in Africa, in the African continent, the European empires get together and convene in a series of conferences. And the United States had representatives at these conferences. And they initially came together to make these arguments that Arabs are engaging in slavery in Africa. And the Europeans, with a higher, you know, level of civilization, having gone through a process of abolition, the Europeans, it's their God-given right, or I'm sorry, their God-given duty to go and end this slavery in the African continent. And what are the mechanisms to do so? Build roads, build ports, build railroads. Right. And so the scramble for Africa that we think of, you know, is a direct outcome of this language of anti-slavery. So I think there are connections in North America, the history of this continent, and the history of the African continent.
Because as you write, the United States is profoundly unexceptional. The Central Pacific and Union Pacific Railroads are manifestations of a broad historical process that you call railroad colonialism.
Yes, yes. So, you know, that's the story of how the railroad is remembered is that I started out with this, you know, national infrastructure. I think it's a key aspect of that story of American exceptionalism. And, you know, to remember again, you know, the voice of Dr. King today, I think he was speaking against that idea of American exceptionalism. Mm. Yeah.
Today we're speaking with Manu Kuruka. He's author of Empire's Tracks, Indigenous Nations, Chinese Workers, and the Transcontinental Railroad. He is Assistant Professor of American Studies at Barnard College in New York. Let's go next to Greg in Palo Alto. Hi, Greg. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you. You know, as I was listening to this discussion you're having, something occurred to me, and that was when I was a high school student, a college student, I don't recall ever getting any kind of honest accounting of American history. And as I listened, I was thinking, you know, we've been going through this now, the lies, the mythology, the violence in this country from, you know, the celebration of Columbus Day, so 500 years of this, and it's still going on today. It's nothing new. I mean, we've got a president who just lies all the time, as well as other politicians, about what's going on. So it's amazing to me that this has gone on for 500 years, and we still celebrate Columbus Day. It's still a holiday. So I'm. It's just sad, I mean, to listen to this, and you know, that a country could be so unrealistic about what happened in its history, and we still exist to these lies and myths going forward. So that's my comment. Thanks for the program.
Thank you, Greg.
Thanks for that comment. Yeah, I think, you know, I agree, and I think that one, you know, response to that is the necessity for us to study and read. And, you know, to really carefully read and study. So there's a huge, beautiful, centuries-long literature of what we might call Native American studies or indigenous studies. Really, you know, this is about indigenous politics and indigenous analyses of capitalism and imperialism and of freedom. And at the heart of this centuries-long tradition of thought is really this question, where am I, that I started out with? And that's, I think, a question that each one of us, no matter who we are, it's actually a really important question for us to ask. Where am I? Mm. You know, that's an ecological question.
Yeah.
That's a social question. That's a political question.
Yeah, thank you, Greg. And also, we should say that so many cities across the country are replacing Columbus Day with Indigenous Peoples Day. And, I mean, I completely understand what Greg is saying, but I feel like there's more information getting out, and people are fighting to say, look, we want Indigenous Peoples Day. We no longer want Columbus Day. And I think that just happened in, I want to get my facts right here, in New Mexico? Yes, New Mexico replaces Columbus Day with Indigenous Peoples Day. Just stories out today about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, there's work to read. So, you know, there's a scholar and activist based in New Mexico who I have the deepest admiration for, Nick Estes, and a new book, Our History is the Future. It's out on Verso, and it's a long history of the movement at Standing Rock. And in many ways, if anyone's listening and is interested in the conversation we're having, I hope you read Empire's Tracks, but I also urge you to read Our History is the Future. Which I think can teach all of us a lot about where we are.
Mm, yeah. Well, thank you so much for calling in, Greg. This hour has flown by. Since you talked about the environment and ecology, we've had Winona LaDuke on the show many, many times, Indigenous activists. But I love the section that you have with Winona LaDuke, Killing Without Reverence. You write, for Winona LaDuke, Indigenous relations with non-human animals, plants, rocks, and waters are older relatives, the ones who came before and taught us how to live, from the foundations for Indigenous collective life. And I just love this part because I think it's just, it's so interesting to think about the land this way. In this section, you write, the prairie, the single largest ecosystem in North America, was cultivated by massive roaming buffalo herds. A century and a half after the initial colonization of the region, the ecosystem has been remade to support the cattle industry, from feed crop monoculture to feedlots, from underpriced public permits to drawdown of the aquifers, soil erosion. I mean, destroying the biodiversity and much of the life and the largest community of plants and animals on the continent.
Yes. And, you know, these are all lessons that I've learned from LaDuke's work and from her writing and her activism. And, you know, this is as material as we can be. This is about how do we live and the relationship between different forms of life and different ways, forms of knowledge in a place. She just, I take this as an argument about a centuries-long, generations-long process of co-evolution that makes a place. We could talk about the plains. We could talk about the Amazonian rainforest. We could talk about many different parts of the world. And, you know, colonialism, imperialism reduces that biodiversity that's created through that process of co-evolution. It also has effects. So, you know, that colonization of the plains, you know, this rich area of life in the continent of North America, that process that you just read from that section, then also shapes and really constricts the possibilities for rural, for peasants and rural workers in Africa, in Asia, in Latin America, who simply can't compete with subsidized farming and ranching that's happening in North America on the same exact place where that process of co-evolution has been arrested. So this is another reason why I think imperialism is the category that can help us to see the relationships between people in these different places, between workers and farmers and dispossessed people.
And as we're talking about the Green New Deal, I think this is such an important part of that, because I feel like sometimes, and we talk about this on this show, but we talk about, well, what do we need to change within this system? And we're talking about small change, even though the, you know, bringing electric cars and solar panels and wind turbines and all of that, very, very important. But to really go deeper and look at the relationship to the land and really how it has changed as a result of colonialism, that is that should be an integral part of the conversations around the Green New Deal.
I agree. And, you know, just thinking about technology. What kind of technologies are we developing? The U.S. military for over a decade now has been actually has research programs in weapons that are run by renewable energy. So, you know, is that how do we make sure that we have an ecological vision that doesn't include the ability to kill in more devastating and more powerful and dominating ways?
Mm. You end the book. We have just about a minute left. As Ella Deloria, Sarah Winnemucca, Winona LaDuke, and other anti-colonial indigenous feminists have been warning for several generations, there is no alternative, decolonization or mass extinction. We're hearing a lot more about decolonization. What does that mean to you?
Decolonization, I think, well, you know, we're also here celebrating the 50th anniversary of the Third World Liberation Front, the Third World Student Strike at San Francisco State and UC Berkeley. And these were movements of working class students from a multiracial group of working class students from the Bay Area who insisted on a new field of study, what my teacher Gary Okihiro calls third world studies. And they were talking about decolonization. And there's ways in North America that when people talk about decolonization, they maybe imagine that this is somehow symbolic or cultural. Mm. But they and the indigenous feminists I'm reading in the book, we're talking about decolonization in really concrete ways. It's about the relationship to the land. It's about the kind of work that you do in relation to the land and in relation to the others around you, other humans and non-human animals, non-human life forms. So decolonization is something really concrete. And this is a lesson I take from these indigenous feminists. Decolonization is necessary if we want to have life in the future. Decolonization is necessary. You know, this is the highest urgency for us. You know, I'm thinking there also of Rosa Luxemburg, the great German communist leader and thinker who, at the outbreak of the First World War in despair, wrote a pamphlet called the Junius Pamphlet, which ends with the famous phrase, socialism or barbarism? And I think this is the question for us.
Well, huge respect for your work.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for writing this book, and thank you for coming in.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Manu Kuruka is Assistant Professor of American Studies at Barnard College in New York, where he focuses on the intersections of imperialism and capitalism. He is the author of the new book, Empire's Tracks, Indigenous Nations, Chinese Workers, and the Transcontinental Railroad. And I have to apologize. We didn't even talk about the Chinese workers. We really just scratched the surface of this incredible book. So I hope you can find it at your local bookstore and read it. Thanks again for coming in.
Thank you very much.
If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, yourcall@kalw.org. You can listen to past shows and podcast the show, yourcallradio.org. Thanks to Laura Wenis for producing today's show, Kevin Vance, our studio engineer, and thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.